I come to this House of the People to speak to you and all Americans, certain that we stand at a defining hour. Halfway around the world, we are engaged in a great struggle in the skies and on the seas and sands. We know why we're there. We are Americans, part of something larger than ourselves. What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind: peace and security, freedom, and the rule of law.
Some 30 years ago, US President George H.W. Bush told the world that the international community had embraced what he called a new world order. Washington was filled with hubris in the supposed end of history, the triumph of democracy and a unipolar world. But now Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak promises a major increase in defence spending to 2.5% of GDP and what he calls the biggest strengthening of our national defence in a generation. Should we therefore look back at the past three decades very differently as an aberration and contemplate a much more dangerous and difficult time ahead? Back in 1991, the United States built an extraordinary coalition of nations, including Arab states, to work together to liberate Kuwait from Saddam Hussein's Iraqi army. But when Bush's son became president 10 years later, the US and Britain failed badly in Iraq. And two decades after the Americans put boots on the ground in Afghanistan, Joe Biden scuttled the American military mission there. The Taliban took over. Now, in 2024, Gaza, Ukraine and other conflicts mean the 1990s idea of a cohesive international community is stretched to breaking point. The big question is whether the world can be brought together to work for peace when rearmament suggests we all face very dangerous times ahead. I'm Gavin Essler, and this is Not a Drone. In January this year, the head of the British Army, General Sir Patrick Sandars, told a military conference that the United Kingdom, and by extension Europe and beyond, is at a historical turning point. We're moving from a post-war society, he said, to a pre-war society. Wise politicians should take preparatory steps to enable placing our societies on a war footing. Action from the international community was not merely desirable, but essential. Cue alarm in Downing Street, the Ministry of Defence and elsewhere, leading to Rishi Sunak's significantly increased military spending commitments.
I believe we must do more to defend our country, our interests and our values. So today I'm announcing the biggest strengthening of our national defence for a generation. We will increase defence spending to a new baseline of 2.5% of GDP by 2030.
Beyond the current conflict in Gaza, those regional strategic rivals, Iran and Israel, have moved from proxy battles to the first direct attacks on each other's territories, although they have pulled back from the brink of a wider conflict, for now at least. Then, after American and British air forces helped repel the potentially massively destructive Iranian assault on Israel itself, the US congressional logjam on aiding Ukraine suddenly broke apart. Billions of dollars are earmarked for Ukraine, suggesting the war is entering a new phase. On This Is Not a Drill, we wanted to bring together our presenters to assess where all this may be headed. Is there really an international community nowadays? Are we merely nations joined in alliances of convenience to further our own strategic interests while intentionally or unintentionally undermining the United Nations and global cooperation? Emma Beals is an independent consultant and senior advisor at the European Institute for Peace. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Gavin.
Joining us also is conflict correspondent Oz Kutergi. Oz recently reported from Kiev in a new documentary. Thanks for joining us, Oz.
Hello.
First, the complex layers of the Israel-Iran-Gaza conflict. When Israel hit the Iranian diplomatic mission in Syria, Iran telegraphed its retaliation in advance, and almost all Iranian missiles and drones were destroyed by Israel, the US, and British forces. Israel then, at least so far, confined its retaliation to a symbolic attack near the site of Iran's nuclear weapons research complex. Has common sense prevailed? Sort of. Emma, what do you make of this? I mean, we're still waiting to see if another shoe's going to drop, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's less maybe about common sense and more to do with an enormous diplomatic effort and sort of self-interest and de-escalation. Because after the Israeli attack on the embassy in Damascus, the Iranian embassy, tensions really did skyrocket. You know, Israel often strikes Iranian targets in Syria, but an embassy is a different level. So previously, they had been more military-related targets. And that sort of necessitated a response just based on how the world works and how sort of states posture and so forth. But there's been a vast number of phone calls. So the United States were calling Gulf states who were calling Iran and, you know, and back again to Israel and so on. And while regional states are concerned about Iran and their regional role, both in the war in Gaza, but more broadly through their proxy militias across the region, they're also really concerned about the belligerence and the approach of the Israeli government, both in terms of how they're conducting operations in Gaza, but how they're increasing tensions in Lebanon. They're also worried, of course, about Jordan and Egypt. So, you know, I think there's this idea that everyone came together to defend Israel, but I think it was more to defend stability in the region. So it was very much, you know, from the Jordanian perspective about preserving their sovereignty. Obviously, they're kind of in the middle of it. And it was very much about trying to de-escalate, trying to make sure that there wasn't a broader regional war between two actors that are really a major concern, you know, and the region obviously doesn't want to collectively be plunged into further war. I think the amount of resource that went into it, just the amount of diplomatic leverage and time spent shouldn't be underestimated. So ultimately, for now, yes, cooler heads, but I think the wild card at the moment and the thing to continue watching is the Israeli appetite for continued escalation or continued sort of potential to want to escalate there.
Oz, that's a very good point, isn't it? What do you make of this? Because we're also talking about not just the future of Israel, but very particularly about the future of Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister, and he perhaps has slightly different interests from the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a really, really complicated and nuanced topic. The way I understand it, and I may be wrong, but this is how I perceive the Netanyahu regime, and it is a regime to me, even though it has a strong democratically elected component to it. It also requires disenfranchising millions of Palestinians. And then you look at what Netanyahu's doing with the judiciary, and you see that this man is clearly an autocrat, you know, and he's in a coalition with Kahanists. Kahanists, for people that don't know, are a very, very extreme far-right fundamentalist movement, having committed actual massacres against, you know, terrorist massacres against Palestinians, the Cave of the Patriarchs massacre being the most key thing. And the figures that Netanyahu's working with in his cabinet are people that praise this terrorist who gunned down Palestinians in the Cave of the Patriarchs. So this is the context of who Netanyahu is. And this is why it's dangerous, right? October 7th happened, was a disaster for Israeli security. And Netanyahu's whole thing is, I'm Mr. Security. Netanyahu wants to remain as prime minister. He is facing immense legal problems due to domestic corruption issues. And staying as prime minister is the only way he can ensure that he never gets prosecuted for these things. So Netanyahu courting conflict with Lebanon or Syria or Iran is a very good way to just keep the war footing going, keeping Israelis away from wanting a new election and keeping himself as far away from accountability as possible. Now, the attack on the embassy, right? Look at who Israel killed in Damascus. These were military figures, not just military figures, IRGC figures who are running terrorist operations. So Iran is using an embassy in Damascus to run terrorist operations to target Israel out of. That is completely unacceptable for an embassy. And framing it as in Israel is targeting an embassy, and that's completely against normal diplomatic norms and laws. Yes, you're correct, but so is using an embassy for terrorist purposes. And we all know what Iran's history is with embassies. We all know the hostage taking and the bombing that they've done of embassies. Now, within all of that context, it's difficult to have, you know, a clear narrative about who's right, who's wrong, who's doing what, who's doing, because it's all about self-interest. The Iranians are dealing with self-interest as well. Bashar al-Assad is a name that hasn't been brought up much in this, even though all of these attacks are happening from Syria, inside Syrian soil. The Syrian state isn't getting involved because Bashar al-Assad's in self-preservation mode. Hezbollah didn't get involved in the Iranian attack on Israel because they're in self-preservation mode as well. They don't want a full Israeli response on Lebanese soil. So I think there's a lot of games being played by all of the leading figures in all of this, in Hamas, in Hezbollah, in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Israel. And I think it's a very dangerous period. The people that are going to suffer and are suffering are the civilians, particularly in Gaza, but in elsewhere, in Lebanon, in northern Israel, all, you know, the Iranian attack, the only person that was injured in an Iranian attack was a Bedouin girl, a child. So it's a very dangerous time period. And there's no one here that any sort of liberal internationalist can say these guys are doing the right thing. These guys are people that we can support. And really, I would like to push this back towards the US as my final point. The US's patronage of Israel, no matter what Israel does, we're starting to see some real cracks in that relationship, particularly with Biden. But that relationship really needs to fundamentally change for there to be any kind of progress towards a peace, a Palestinian state, de-escalation in the region.
Well, let me pick up that point, because what we do know is that there is a further complication outside the region, which is the American election timetable. And there are growing numbers of Muslim voters in key US states. There are also student protests that have shown that many Americans are appalled by the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. And Biden wants to be seen as a defender of Israel, but he's not delighted by Netanyahu. Emma, I just wondered what you think is going on there in terms of American politics, because Antony Blinken, U.S. Secretary of State, has been very, very active. Do you think Biden is playing what is a very difficult hand for him quite well, actually?
Well, yes and no. So I think that we can't ignore the fact that Biden and his administration are partly responsible for the hand that they've been dealt. It's very easy to sort of say, you know, that this just happened out of nowhere. I think Obama extended enormous capital on the Iran nuclear deal, and not to get into whether we thought that was a right or wrong, but Trump got out of it, and then Biden tried to re-engage in it and failed. Trump, you know, was obviously antagonistic towards Iran, and then that has sort of been ramped up with Biden's sort of bear hug towards Netanyahu since October, which is again antagonistic towards Iran. You know, in the Gulf, folks see the US as a bit untrustworthy as well, and that predates the current conflict. You know, critical points of engagement where some of the same administration were in power under Obama, so the chemical weapons attack in Syria and so forth, which came to kind of represent the beginning of US isolationism, which has continued through all of those administrations. But Biden very much was trying to get out of the Middle East. You know, we can't forget after the earthquake in Syria last year, quite happy to sort of disengage a lot from Syria and allow the Arab states to move back towards Bashar al-Assad, for example, because they were worried about the vacuum that was being created in the region because of sort of US disengagement. And let's not forget this administration's most senior advisor, Jake Sullivan, claimed in Foreign Affairs magazine, very important magazine, just days before October 7, that the Middle East was quieter than it had been in decades. Largely, he claimed, as a result of the United States' de-escalatory policy in order to reduce the US footprint in the region rather than resolving those crises so that they could pivot to other priorities, the Asia Pacific, Ukraine, and so forth. So has he been handed a bad hand in terms of this crisis? Yes, of course. It's quite impossible in many ways. You know, there are no easy answers here. Is he playing it well? I mean, I think a different approach with Israel from the start would have been preferable. You know, we have seen in recent weeks that there is a greater ability to contain Israel's actions than we have seen previously. And I think domestically, this is harming Biden, and I don't think he's playing that hand very well. And I think when you look at the polling data coming out of the US and you look at who is very upset about Gaza, it's young people, it's Black voters, it's Arab American voters. It wildly pivots towards Democratic voters. And I think there's an arrogance to the way that it's being narrated by the Democrats. And I've seen one person speaking in an intelligent way about it, and that's AOC, to sort of say, you don't need to agree with this, but who would you even be able to have an argument with? And I think her framing of it is the first time I've seen someone from the current Democratic Party really trying to explain it in a way that doesn't just come off as dismissive and arrogant. So there's a huge risk with what's going to happen with the election, particularly around foreign policy. There was a perception from this administration that voters' interests in foreign policy, that foreign policy for the middle class, which was the pillar of their foreign policy, was only about supply chains. It was only about how many American youth were boots on the ground abroad. And it was only about jobs and manufacturing, that it wasn't actually going to overlay with concerns around social justice and race relations and so on, which it has done. And that's something that he's needing to deal with. And I'm not sure that he's necessarily balancing his approach in a particularly helpful way. I may be wrong, but I mean, I certainly have concerns about how that's playing out.
I don't want to ask Oz how it's going to end, but if you do know how all this is going to end, Oz, do tell us. But what I do want to pick up on is this thought that Emma raised there, that there really has been a generational change compared to 30 years ago and the unipolar world. And she referred to AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democratic congresswoman, who is of a different generation. And I just wondered whether that is very important, in fact, in American and other politics, that there is a younger generation of politicians and others who don't look at Israel as the victim so much as the bully in this case. And that has changed.
Look, I'll be honest, I think that narrative is slightly overblown because, look, I'm a millennial. I remember when I was growing up and people were saying, when this generation grows up, the attitude towards Israel is going to be very different. And my generation has grown up. We've now got prime ministers who are the same age as me across Europe, you know, not many, but there are some, right? And nothing massive has changed, to be honest with you. Now, there have been nuances to that, obviously, and Europe is much more progressive towards the establishment of a Palestinian state and holding Israel to account for its occupation than the United States is. But the opposition to Biden is a hard right, extremely pro-Israel, extremely pro-Netanyahu government that tried to overthrow the last democratically elected president in the United States. This is a failed putschist, you know, it's even wrong to call a government. It would be a regime under Trump, right? So the idea that there's any kind of meaningful opposition to this in a way that's going to change the system fundamentally, it's just not borne out by the polling. It's not borne out by the political reality of what's going on in both parties. Nothing's changed. Quite honestly, the situation in Israel and Palestine is significantly worse than it was when I was a child. I would really caution people against looking at young people protesting and saying, well, don't worry, 20 years' time, these guys will all be in charge and there'll be a big change. No, that's not how history works. That's not how society works. So I don't think that's going to happen. And I think the only way that we're going to affect real change is when the current governments that we have, the current leaders that we have, are able to affect that change. But at the end of that, I wanted to turn it back around to you, Gavin, because this is a panel show. So I'd really like to hear your insights on this and to turn the question back to you. Where do you think we are? Where do you think we're heading?
Well, I can be very, very brief on that. I never thought that the choice facing a great country that I love very much, the United States, with 370 million people, would be between someone like Joe Biden and someone like Donald Trump. So if we're talking in the biggest terms, I am somewhat depressed about the choice that democracies are throwing up, not just there, but also in Europe itself. And that doesn't even get us on to what's happening in the Middle East. And I was there when Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat appeared to do the one thing which I thought might be impossible, but they seem to have done it, which was to sign a reasonable peace deal that possibly was going to bring about a two-state solution, and Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by an Israeli extremist.
By an Israeli Kahanist, effectively, right?
Exactly.
Who are now in the government. And that's, you're not even allowed to bring that up anymore. You're not even allowed to say, hey, well, that's a problem for American foreign policy.
It's a very big problem for American foreign policy.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
We're now witnessing the latest phase of the long drawn out congressional struggle over Ukraine. And we also have the prospect of a Donald Trump quasi isolationist presidency. Should political leaders, especially in Ukraine and across NATO, be worried about American staying power? And what does America's uncertain role in the world after November's election tell us about the likely geopolitical landscape in the next few years? Oz, how seriously do the Ukrainians, just ordinary Ukrainians that you talk to, worry that the US under Trump just simply could abandon them?
So this is another very complicated and long question to answer. So I'm going to do my best to be brief, right? For start, I think we should point out that I do not think it's a certainty that Donald Trump's going to win the presidency. In fact, I think that Joe Biden is doing much better than the current polling indicates that he's doing. And Donald Trump's legal jeopardy is only just beginning now. From this point, things could get significantly worse for him. That aside, one of the articles I wrote at the end of last year, Foreign Policy, was that Ukraine must prepare for political disaster in 2024. Now, some of Trump's more heterodox critics, shall we call them, an interesting way to describe someone like Michael Tracy, are very insistent right now that Trump is behind this Ukraine aid. Lindsey Graham has come out and said, Trump is the reason this Ukraine aid got passed. That's rubbish. There are more nuances and complexities about American politics than just Trump dictates everything in the Republican Party right now. And that's what's happened. Trump did not manage to get his way on Ukraine. But, you know, Mike Johnson turned away from the Trump position. I don't know the reasons why Mike Johnson finally brought that vote to the floor. Only Mike Johnson could really tell you, and I doubt he'd tell you the truth. But the important thing to remember is there is still a bipartisan consensus in Congress to support Ukraine. There are a lot of pro-Trump Republicans now, a growing number, who are opposed to that aid, but that this is a defeat for Trump. Now, moving on to the wider question. Yes, I do think a Trump presidency would be a disaster, not just for Ukraine, but much, much, much larger. I think for Palestine too. I think that he will try and negotiate parts of Ukraine to give to Putin. He's been very clear in his speeches when he talks about that. And I think that the view from Ukraine is one of worry. We could spend 4 hours talking about what a Trump presidency could be. I'd rather park that because none of that's certain. What I can say is whether or not Trump comes into power, Europe really needs to take Ukraine's security much more seriously. This is a European question now. And the European Union has the financial power to be able to match America's contributions so far. It really is on Europeans to rearm, to start producing enough artillery ammunition in particular, and to start getting Ukraine the support that they promised that it would have before the war began, or even going far back as the Budapest agreements. These are things that are fundamental to European security. And look, the way the Republican Party has been trending towards a Christian fundamentalist, far right, racist, isolationist, pro-dictatorship movement. I don't think that Trump is the only reason for this. And I don't think that when Trump is finally gone, whenever that happens, I don't think that that European security can rely on the Republican Party as allies anymore. And this announcement from Rishi Sunak yesterday, which mirrors what Labour have been talking about increasing defence spending significantly, rearming the country in the face of what potentially a pre-war time period right now. People will say that's alarmist, but European leaders need to take this question seriously, and we need to start being able to defend ourselves without requiring the Americans to step in. That's been something that helped us in the post-war period. But as I said, the post-war period ended in February 2022. We're entering a new phase of our history now, and it's time we started acting like it.
Emma, how serious is the trust deficit about the United States under a Trump presidency? I mean, people across Europe, many people in Europe simply do not trust him with good reason. And in that case, is there a way that the European Union or the European pillar of NATO can pick up the slack in any way?
Well, I think it's interesting to talk about a lack of trust in the US under Trump, but I think there's also a lack of trust in the US now, because it's come up both in terms of getting this funding through, which is in part to do with the you know, system of government in the US. It means that even under a Biden presidency, the Republicans can sort of hold up the spending bill and so on. So that creates a lack of trust in the Ukraine context. We've talked about a lack of trust of the US in the Middle East and, you know, certainly before October even in terms of their policies. And I think it's notable that the conversation about a lack of trust in US foreign policy comes up around both of these conflicts, and that these are the two conflicts that the US is even bothering to engage in. There's also a critique that there's a lack of trust in the US more broadly at the moment because they're engaged in these two conflicts at the expense of all others, and they're not engaging in any of these other issues that are going on globally. So I think that, yes, we can talk about a lack of, you know, concern and about what would happen under Trump, but I think there's just concern about where the US is. But I think it would be a mistake to think that a second Trump term would be anything like a first Trump term. So under the first Trump presidency, the institutions held for the most part, right? You had a career civil service, and sure, a lot of people left the State Department and so forth. But even in terms of a lot of the political appointees, for the most part, they were people who were trying to do a good job. You may not necessarily entirely agree with their politics or whatever, that's up to you on an individual basis. But for the most part, they were trying to keep the ship running straight. So Trump would tweet some wild policy, and then everybody underneath would try to make sure that he forgot about it for the next 6 months, and they just continued doing what they were doing. And this is sort of how it operated. And everyone just white-knuckled it through 4 years, going, oh, in the next election, it will be fine. In the next election, it will be fine. But Trump has learned his lesson, and he won't do that again. He thinks that's the deep state. He will purge. He will put people in place who will do his bidding entirely. But we've also seen the Republican Party has become a function of him as well. And so I think in terms of how he would engage in foreign policy, not just him, but how the institutions would be able to engage in foreign policy under a Trump presidency, it would be much more harmful and difficult for allies to continue to engage in the way that they did under the first Trump term. So it's not only an existential threat to American democracy, but also to multilateral institutions. You know, the UN is on the hit list. NATO is on the hit list. I mean, the UN not functioning particularly well at the moment, but it's the best we've got, so we've got to keep it, you know.
And, I might disagree and the world there. Order. I do think the UN could use a little bit of crazy reform right here. You know, I'm not going to lose sleep if the UN Security Council disappears overnight, you know.
Oh, look, I think I'm, you know me, I have criticized the UN more than most, but I still think it's that reforming the UN is the best that we have at the moment. Even the international financial institutions who were meeting in DC last week were sort of saying, with all of this uncertainty, we don't really know what's happening. We, you know, there's a hugely uncertain economic environment. Things will be clearer next spring once all these elections have happened. The state of geopolitics, you know, will be a little clearer. So not only do we have this great power competition and fragmentation, but we have a deep uncertainty through that as well. And so I think that is really making it difficult for people to navigate even this changing world because there are just these huge known unknowns, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, and we're not sure what will happen there.
I would just add my three halfpence worth by saying that I once said to a British diplomat, who's a friend of mine, longtime friend of mine at the UN, isn't it about time that the UN was reformed? Instead of having Britain and France, the allies from World War II, as permanent members of the Security Council, perhaps a European Union seat, Britain would lose its veto. And he said, "My dear boy, if we were threatened with losing our veto at the UN, we would veto it."
Exactly.
So I don't think it's going to happen.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
Finally, before we leave you, let's have a brief look at the stories and geopolitical issues which we might be facing this summer, this year, and perhaps beyond. I'm going to start with the British Isles and Ireland in particular, because there will be an Irish general election before March 2025. And the reason this is important and interesting is that Sinn Féin could become the biggest party on both parts of the island of Ireland. They're already the biggest party in government in Northern Ireland, working with the Democratic Unionist Party. It's quite remarkable. And one of the things that I'm really struck about is that in British schools, we are taught that at the end of World War I, Germany lost a vast amount of its land because it lost the war, and it was 13% of its landmass. What we are not taught is that the United Kingdom, as then constituted, lost 22% of its land when the 26 counties of Ireland seceded. So this will, if it is a Sinn Féin victory in the south as well as in the north of Ireland, this will be hugely significant, not just for the future of Ireland, both parts of Ireland, where that will go, but also for the United Kingdom. And I think maybe we should look sometimes at our own history in a slightly different way. Oz, what's the news, good or bad, that we need to pay attention to this summer and beyond?
Okay, bad news first. Russia is preparing for another large-scale offensive in Ukraine. Ukraine has been on the back foot for a long time, hasn't had the ammunition to defend itself. The thing to look out for in Ukraine is what happens with this Russian attack and where do the chips fall after that. If Ukraine successfully defeats this Russian offensive, and I think there's a very, very, very good chance that Ukraine inflicts serious damage on Russia in this attack, you may be looking at the position where Russia is militarily exhausted, and then Ukraine can start gaining some advantages on the battlefield. That's potential. It could go the other way too. So the bad news is Russia's going to attack Ukraine big time. How does Ukraine handle that? That will not just set the tone for 2025, but it will set the tone for European security for the rest of the decade, effectively. Czech ammunition drive, Estonian ammunition drive, EU rearmaments, Denmark, Netherlands, Germany, etc., getting their act together, Britain announcing more aid, and the biggest one of all, the US announcing the $61.4 billion aid package. All of these things are going to start coming into play in the summer. And that means Ukraine is going to be in a much better position when, in terms of material and hopefully manpower, with their new draft law coming in. However, that doesn't change the dynamics. The dynamics are Ukraine's in the defensive posture. Russia is on the attack. So I think we really need to be prepared for that in any way that we can.
Emma, what's your predictions for the summer or the year ahead?
Look, my crystal ball is in the shop, so I've got no predictions for you. But some of the things I'm going to be looking at is, we're going to talk about it in an upcoming pod, but the elections coming up, we're hitting some of the big batches of elections that are coming up in the biggest election year ever. Obviously, climate change coming into summer, last year where there was fires and floods and it was all a little bit Armageddon, you know, with the oceans heating up and things getting a little unpredictable, and this being kind of the second year where that's starting to look like a more consistent pattern, I think it's going to be something to be watching out for. We do tend to see an influx of med crossings during the summer. Of course, people taking to boats and so forth, it's a little less fatal potentially to do that during the summer months. And I think that, you know, with everything that's going on in Sudan, in Gaza, you know, unresolved conflicts in Syria, a declining security situation for Syrians in Lebanon, you have just the potential for it to be a relatively big year for migration. And that obviously has knock-on effects on domestic politics. And so that will be something that I think is worth keeping an eye on. And then I will be watching the US polling data going up and down like my life depends on it.
And me too, I think. Well, thank you, Emma. Thank you, Oz. Thank you both for taking part. Thank you, listeners, for joining us on This Is Not a Drill. A special thank you for all those who support us in making this podcast by subscribing through Patreon. Your backing is hugely appreciated. It helps keep this a truly global endeavor, speaking each week to leading experts worldwide and those on the ground, reporting on some of the most difficult and important stories facing us today. If you'd like to help us keep you in the know with behind the headlines reports on the key flashpoints around the world, search for This Is Not a Drill Patreon and you can sign up to support us for as little as £3 a month. I'm Gavin Essler. This is Not a Drill. Goodbye.
This Is Not a Drill. It's written and presented by Gavin Essler with Emma Beals and Oz Cassidy. It was produced by Robin Lieber with music by Paul Hartman and art by Jim Parrott. Group editor is Andrew Harrison, executive producer Martin Boytosh. This Is Not a Drill is a Podmasters production.